Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Fearless Writing Telesummit. My name's Cora Vasour, and I'm your host, and I'm thrilled to be here with Ani Tuzman. Before I introduce you to Ani, I'm going to tell you a little bit about the Telesummit. I put together the Fearless Writing Telesummit because I'm also a writer, and I know how real some of the fears feel that are coming up for writing around rewriting and sending work out. So I wanted to put together 21 experts that are going to help us with different areas of those fears and how to work with them so we can pursue our dreams of writing. One fear that I know feels really real for a lot of us, me included, is doubt. And all this not believing in our work, not believing in ourselves. It feels really real. It feels huge. And it's what stops a lot of us from going forward and pursuing our dreams. So I'm thrilled to have Ani here, who's going to help us with that. And a little bit about Ani. Ani Tuzman wrote her first piece of fiction, a short story, when she was 7. She has not stopped since, despite significant challenges along the way. Ani's poetry and prose have been published internationally and translated into several languages. For the past 3 decades, Ani has mentored writers from 8 to 88 at the Dance of Letters Writing Center that she founded in Western Massachusetts, and whose services she is now bringing online. Hailed as the writer's midwife, Ani is now in the process of bringing her own book into the world. Her historical novel, Tremble of Love, is inspired by the life of legendary 18th century Kabbalist, healer, and spiritual teacher, and is the first of a series of 3 historical novels featuring the transformative presence of love. Now that her 3 children are raised, Ani is intent on birthing at least twice that many books in the years to come. Ani, welcome to the Telesummit.
Thank you, Cora. Thank you. I'm so glad to be here.
I'm so glad you get to speak with us. I know you have a lot to talk about, and one of the first things you want to talk about is what you're calling the demon of doubt. I know you're going to talk about keeping on. And can you tell us a little bit more what you mean by the demon of doubt?
Sure. So, as many people know, doubt is really fear disguised.
Mm-hmm.
So I think of the demon of doubt as a trickster, a master of delusion.
Yeah.
And when I talk about dancing with the demon of doubt, well, for one, it lightens it up a little bit. But also, doubt really courts us, tempts us, even sweeps us off our feet. And often, in the name of convincing us, it's protecting us. And that's, I think, what it's really trying to do. From harm in the form of shame or failure, even financial ruin as writers. And so what's interesting, too, is that doubt can also spur us to yearn for and seek what's true, kind of like lifting the veil of doubt and seeing really what's the truth and finding our own truth in the face of whatever others have said or told us, or we hear about fiction writers, you know, making a living, whatever it is, we can find our own truth. And doubt, interestingly enough, can spur us to that. And our truth, the truth of our passion and our commitment to writing, despite doubt.
Yeah. Why do you think doubt creeps into so many writers?
Oh, golly, we're opening to our passion. You know, we're opening to what we love. And I'll share a little bit later about my own journey, and it illustrates, I think people will be able to, obviously everyone's journey is so different, but people will be able to see their own, perhaps, and their own obstacles, inner and outer, and how the seeds of doubt, many of us got planted in our childhoods and continue to be, you know, kind of tended along by a lot of people and messages we get. But a lot of the seeds of doubt, I think, came in our childhoods. And hopefully not for all writers, but truly for many of us.
Yeah.
And
Go ahead. Oh, no, finish what you're saying. That's more important.
No, I have a wonderful and totally unexpected experience to share. It was totally unexpected at the time, that really lifted what I thought of as doubt's cape, and really helped me see through and see more clearly. And if it's okay, I'd like to share that story.
Yes, please do.
Well, my daughter, a singer-songwriter, was just starting her career, was visiting from California. And at the time, I was applying for a grant, a really decent-sized grant, bigger than most, that would help me live while I finished a novel I was working on. And the grant required a really challenging and comprehensive application with numerous essays. And I was deep in the process of writing one of these essays about my writing life. But I realized that even as I was doing it, I was feeling discouraged about my prospects. And I'd entered numerous writing contests, submitted chapbooks to competitions, chapters of my novel to, you know, state art council fellowship grants. And other than two poetry prizes and a couple of close calls, I had not won any of those. Yeah. And so when my daughter asked me about the grant, I kind of replied to her from that place of discouragement, fed by doubt.
Right.
Said to her, you know, I wish I were an example for you of someone who succeeded in making a living from her art.
Oh.
I almost cried, and what she said in reply completely surprised me. And she just looked me right in the eyes and said, "But Mama, you have been an inspiration. You never give up."
Oh, that's great.
And then she went on to say, you know, you've been writing since I can remember, and you keep writing no matter what. It inspires me not to give up either.
Oh, that's wonderful.
I share that because, you know, my daughter's reflection really helped me and helped me see that not giving up, keeping on, without the rewards, in her eyes, was true inspiration. And I really wanted to reflect that to those listening now, Cora, that of course we want to create well-written, well-read books that impact the world, and we would love to have revenue, basically, so we can keep writing. But it's so crucial to remind ourselves and each other as writers not only to be focused on the product, but to treasure and also feel so grateful for the process of doing what we love, even if we can't control the outcome.
Yeah, very much so. It can get really hard to enjoy the journey along the way.
Yes, yeah, and that's okay too. I mean, we get up and we fall down and we fall down and we get up. It's all part of it. That's the keeping on, keeping on.
Well, before I ask you how you've enjoyed the journey, you said a little bit ago that you felt doubt was protecting us in some way.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I will say a little, and I realize that when I share a little about my journey, that'll really come out clearly. We often have, I had, and others have had, experiences in our childhoods where it wasn't so safe to have a voice. It wasn't so safe to express ourselves, or it wasn't welcomed. It can run the gamut to really harsh responses, to being ignored, when we felt such, many of us have, not everyone, but many of us have been connected or felt that longing to write really young.
Yeah.
And or even those that came to it later. As I said before, there's a vulnerability to creating art. There's power, immense power, but there's also vulnerability because we're really creating from our souls, you know, from our innermost beings. And so while we don't want to kind of you know, blow in the wind of everyone's responses or lack of response, or they like it or they don't like it. Nonetheless, inherent in the process really is this, in a way, precious vulnerability. It makes the writing more alive when we've written from that place. But it isn't received, and as I said, I'll give some examples of that. When it isn't received, a seed of doubt gets planted.
Mm-hmm.
And later on, if other things happen, even in other arenas of our life, if we fail at whatever, you know, we fail at a marriage, quote-unquote fail, you know, whatever, we layer that on top of the messages inside that may say, oh, you'll never, or oh, you'll always.
Right.
And those are the voices of doubt.
Yeah, and really let us know.
You said, how are they keeping us safe? Well, from being hurt again. You know, it's kind of contorted. We have to see through it and you know, dance with it sometimes and, you know, and untangle ourselves. But there is an impulse to protect ourselves. I mean, there's an impulse within us. The doubt is kind of part of us. It's there to keep us safe from taking risks. And, of course, writing openly and honestly and powerfully is, in a sense, a risk.
Mm-hmm. So, well, why don't you tell us a little about your journey and the stops and starts along the way?
Great. So talk about giving up. I had lots of chances to give up along the way, and I did for periods of time, but I always came back. And a central theme in my writing and in my life's journey has been having a voice and valuing my voice.
Yeah.
But my life has been chock full of chances to learn to trust my voice and my writing.
Right.
And those chances and those opportunities coming through challenge, in broad strokes. I started writing and yearning to write as a very young girl, staring and waiting to figure out what the black marks were that were crawling across my father's newspaper. Just staring, thinking if I stared hard enough, code would be revealed. I knew there was power because reading that made him yell, made him laugh, made him crack. And so I knew what's going on. So I waited. And then the day came in kindergarten, I remember I was officially introduced to my first letter. And from then on, I was ecstatic. But my parents were recent immigrants to the United States. And very soon, because of how different I was than the others in school, I became the subject of really harsh teasing and then shaming by not only the children, but it wasn't only the children, it was by my third grade teacher. And what happened was my classmates learned really quickly that if someone would throw a spitball or drop a book and make a loud sound when the teacher's back was turned, she would whip around and point to me.
Oh, no.
It sounds not true, but it is, and my punishment was to write, I will not disturb the class, or I will be quiet, I will keep quiet, and I'd have to write it 500 times on the class blackboards. In those days, there was like a blackboard on every wall.
Right, yeah.
By the end, I was crying, holding up my hand with my other hand, holding up my arm, and what I learned was very quickly, very profoundly, that to have a voice, especially a different one, is dangerous. And I learned that to be silent is to be safe.
Right.
Now, luckily, I was so whatever, I didn't know the word addicted then, but addicted to writing. I already loved writing by third grade, that I kept writing stories and poems and a lot of secrets. Well, about what was happening in school, in my diary, locked with a key. And in a certain way, my voice was locked.
Okay.
Then when I was 12, my parents, showing off their American daughter, asked me if I would read one of my stories to their only native English-speaking college-educated friend.
Aww.
And they then added proudly that, you know, Ani wants to be a writer.
Mm-hmm.
Excited, I said, because my parents, when I'd read them my things, didn't understand a lot of it, so I was going to read to someone who really knew. And I said, I wanted to be one of the women. There weren't hardly any women in this card game. I don't know if it's still around. It was called Authors. And
okay.
One of the only women in it was Louisa May Alcott. And
right.
I read Little Women, and I wanted to be another woman in the deck. And
okay.
Then I read my story.
Mm-hmm.
And my parents' friend's response was, I know it doesn't sound true, but it was, you know, you can never be a great writer like those
oh,
writers.
No.
Because English isn't your first language. You'll never, don't even think that. You'll just be disappointed.
Oh, my goodness.
Then he added, whispering when my mother's back was turned, I think my father had gone out of the room to answer the phone or something, and he said,
mm-hmm.
You know, you can fool them, but you can't fool me.
Oh.
And, oh, my God. So
really?
I learned another lesson, you know,
yeah.
For what I did, I was born not good enough, and also that someone else, not me, is the judge of that.
Yeah. Because,
you know, he was a supreme example of authority, and even not as kids, as adults, we give our authority away to others who pronounce the, you know, verdict on our writing.
Yeah, we do.
So I want to say, pause for a moment before sharing just a little more about my journey, to say that these were unusually harsh and painful experiences, I think, for a child.
Yeah.
But I also want to say that these experiences, I only realized much later, they profoundly impacted not only my writing, but I have for years been leading writing groups for young writers. And gradually switched to just girls at one point when I saw the girls feeling more shame to read in front of the boys, et cetera. And so mm-hmm. It was in the middle. It was probably 12 years into that work when I suddenly
mm-hmm.
went, oh, my God, this is directly connected to that little girl who had no one to protect
yeah.
her, had no one to turn to. You know, she had didn't have it, so I had this vow to do
mm-hmm.
that. So
yeah.
In high school, good news, I was in writing Nirvana. I became co-editor of the journal, and
okay.
writing was heaven.
Mm-hmm.
So when I headed to college, it was to major in English and be a writer, just keep going.
Yeah.
Well, I wound up majoring in protesting the Vietnam War, which tells you
yeah.
Yeah. what we called then in the 60s the establishment.
Right.
And three pivotal things happened that made it easy to quit, easy in quotes, especially
mm-hmm.
given the seeds of doubt that had been planted in my earlier childhood. And again, these might not sound true, but they are, and they also fueled my commitment to writing. But at the time, they devastated me. And the three were the all-male editorial board of a literary magazine, where I went excitedly with a stack of writing,
mm-hmm.
reviewed my writing, called me back, handed it all back like it was some dirty rag. It was kind of funny the way they passed it back, and told me not to bother to submit any more writing until I learned not to write about feelings.
Okay. Oh, wow.
And this was, you know, a few years later, the 70s, the women's movement. That
yeah.
would be hard to you know, but although people probably still believe it now. But at the time, what I came away with was, I write like a girl, you know. And
yeah,
that,
and then that was a bad thing.
Right. Then,
yeah.
to add to that, go figure, my first humanities professor, like my first English literature class,
mm-hmm.
compassionately told me that I was clueless because I didn't
mm-hmm.
know who Freud and I didn't know about the myth of Narcissus. I didn't know who Freud was when we were analyzing a Robert Frost poem. And he
mm-hmm.
called me over to his office and said, you're clueless, aren't you, dear? And I had been one of the only ones in this Ivy League school that hadn't gone to a prep school, but rather a not very good high school.
Right.
And then the final thing, which really turned, I think, again, because of the doubt that was already there, I read and took to heart Eldridge Cleaver's words in a book called Soul on Ice. And he said that until everyone can write poetry, none of us should. That instead we should fight for the rights of others to write.
Yeah.
And I know even though that particular book or story might not have figured into people's lives, that matter of writing being called selfish and self-indulgent, especially fiction or poetry,
mm-hmm.
is something I know that many of us writers have to face. Other people judging that what we're doing isn't as valuable as, you know, other things that we could or should be doing.
Right.
So what I did is I joined the War on Poverty, and the only writing I did for the next 20 years, that's how long I was silenced. Besides journaling, I wrote prolifically on behalf of educating disadvantaged children. It was a good thing to do, but I was cut from a whole other dimension of my writing.
Mm-hmm.
And then just to fast forward, you know, it did come back. I moved to the country. I gave birth to my second child, the daughter I mentioned before. I started to write again, and that's when I started leading writing groups for young writers, and the groups grew and grew. And then, years later, my son was born with a rare and severe heart defect, landing him and me beside him in the intensive care unit of a children's hospital for an entire year. And I wrote my way through that year, mostly prayers, letters to him, and journaling. But I stayed sane. I often say writing has saved my life because when all that difficulty went on as a child and throughout, I was still journaling. I never stopped that. So there was always some place to talk about what was going on. And so when my son and when we came home, his ongoing special needs became my full-time job. And doubt said, come on, forget it. Forget about writing. Give it up. Don't you have enough proof now? And you're not, if you were great, maybe then, but you're not, so give it up. And but I couldn't. I tried.
Right.
I did. But and so I wrote between 11 and 2 a.m. when I could, because it was my best shot at not being interrupted and often falling asleep on my desk.
Okay.
And doubt kept saying, you know, I should take no time away from my duties as mother. But in truth, nurturing and my creativity that way really key in helping me have the energy to nourish this differently abled son, my daughter and my teenage son who was being a teenager. And because I was feeding, you know, that part of me that's core part of me, that my creativity, I had more resources available to give them and to share with them. If I had been denying myself all of that, as I know many people do for their families or whatever, for their work, to deny that longing, we impoverish ourselves, sometimes even make ourselves sick.
Yeah.
When we deny that. And so, you know, I just kept going. And it was during that time that I sent things out and work was published and I kept going, and I completed one novel and that was taken out by an agent and got a lot of responses from editors, but no bites. The line was always, I love it, but not enough to buy it.
Yeah.
And I started another novel that I was called from within write that was set in the 1700s. I'll say more about that a little bit later. There's time, but that's the one you mentioned, The Tremble of Love, inspired by a legendary, powerful healer and spiritual teacher, and talk about doubt telling me it was crazy. At one point I had 100 books out of the local university library because no one book. I needed the history, I needed to know what houses looked like, I needed to know what diseases were, and I needed to know the spiritual history involved, and I had 100 books out, and part of me was so excited and couldn't wait to sneak away and write, even if it was tiny dibs and drabs. And the other part of my doubt was saying, look at that. This is ridiculous.
Yep.
But I did it. And 3 years ago, after years of advocacy for my son, including tons of writing, I procured with grace state and federal funding, so my son is now living under his own roof with help and support.
Okay.
And I've picked up my business, Dance of the Letters, which inspired me to support other writers, and my novel. And pick that up full time now.
That's great. I love how you've been able to take so many challenges and turn them into positive experiences or inspiration. You touched on it a little bit, but what kept you going despite all these inner and outer challenges along the way?
A great question. To write, you know, I realized was a choiceless choice. It feels like I've been given a gift that despite my doubts, despite whatever doubt says and how doubt may clobber me from time to time, I have to try at least my best to give that gift to the world. And interestingly enough, that in so doing, I receive the gift more fully. And though writing has called to me like that along the way, and I call it a choiceless choice, I also have learned more and more that I have had to choose again and again and again to listen to that calling. Choose again and again not to quit. Choose faith that there's a reason for this call, that even if things don't get published or get turned down, there's still value. That's faith. And also in a source within me, my inner being, people have all sorts of names for that source, that inner higher power, that's the source of that call, and that I can trust that. That I can trust if that call is there, that the ability and the support and, of course, my effort to meet the call will help. And so I keep saying yes. And, of course, the yes requires me to create the time and the space, not just big, abstract yes, to actually sit down and write, even when it feels like I'm bushwhacking my way through doubt.
Right.
And so, I tried to summarize real briefly what keeps me going, my love for writing, feeling like I come home to myself when I write, hearing the call and faith in the source of that call, and commitment. But that doesn't mean I don't get ambushed by doubt. I do.
Right.
And when I do, here's a few other things that have helped me in case they're of use to others. I use journaling. So I use writing. I use journaling to free myself from the tangle. And sometimes the way I do that is I actually dialogue with the doubt. I don't try to argue with the doubt anymore and defend myself because that's a losing battle. But I know there are fears underneath. And if I can be almost a compassionate listener in the writing, you know, that way you can write and be both voices in a way if you're connected enough to your inner being. I'll write and I'll ask doubt, what are you afraid of? What are you afraid of? What's underneath this? And I'll also write to that little girl to tell her that I promise now to value her voice and keep her safe.
Oh, nice.
That she doesn't have to be afraid. And the other things I do that have been life-changing is I've been meditating for 30 years.
Okay.
I pray in my own different ways.
Okay.
I take walks in nature. If doubt has really tackled me, like a wrestler in a ring and I can't get up from the count, and I can't get back to the computer, I can't get back to the paper and pen, I go out and take a walk in nature no matter what the weather is. And I keep trying to write my way through doubt.
That's great. How have you been able to create time in your busy schedule to write? I know you said one time you were writing from 11 p.m. to 2 in the morning.
Right. Well, looking for it wherever, and it's not easy, because it's just much easier to say, oh, God, I can't. And I know I've read, some people... The getting up at 4 a.m. that I read about, that never worked for me. Maybe that's because I'm more of a night owl. Now, for some people, so it's really, we're creative in our writing. We need to be really creative in how we make time for it. In so many of us have busy lives. So something I advise the writers that work with me, I never prescribe one way, but what I do suggest is for them to observe, you know, when might work. Some people really don't want to commit to the same time every day. So some of the writers I've worked with have committed to 20 minutes or an hour a day, and they get to pick when, or an hour three times a week. But So to look at what, and also what inspires you, what makes you kind of excited, but also where. You know, some people love to write where it's really noisy. Some people hole up in their basement, you know. Mm-hmm. It's so varied. Some people like it loud and some people like it quiet. And so I encourage people to think about that so that, and also a space. It can help, really, just like when people say with meditation, if you meditate in the same place often, it will kind of, an energy builds up there. And it's true with the creative experience, too. And for some people, they can't write in the same place, and that's all right, too. But whatever works. And if possible, another thing that helps, it sometimes worked in my life and sometimes it hasn't, is if there are other people around one is living with, or even close friends, to tell them, to share one's intention, one's longing, with them, and sort of have an accountability partner, or bookend is another way to say that, to tell someone, you know, I'm going to write now, and I'm starting, like I'm going into my cave, and I'll call you when I'm done. And it's sort of, you know, in a certain way we can feel, if we're not on deadline or, you know, something has been, you know, contracted for publication, there's a feeling like it doesn't matter, who cares, who's waiting. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But we're waiting and we care.
Yeah.
And so to find a friend or, you know, a person that also cares and share your, you know, share our intention with them and be specific, not vague. It really helps to, but it can change. It doesn't have to be rigid. It needs to be, you know, grounded, but it doesn't have to be rigid. Does that help?
Yeah, that helps a lot. I really hope people are getting ideas. What came up for me when you were talking about that, my mom is also a writer, and when I was a baby, she found her writing time. I would always fall asleep in the car, so she'd put me in my car seat and drive me around. So as soon as I fell asleep, she'd pull over, and she knew she had 20 minutes she could write before I woke up again.
Yeah, and I'm so glad you said that. One, I've done that too. And the other one, it reminded me of, I'm so glad you brought that up, is I started to do, I would go in the woods with my daughter in the backpack, or I started to carry a tape recorder. And now there are so many digital recorders or the iPhone.
Yeah.
And I still do that. And so that way, driving somewhere, waiting for children, if there are children, you know, to pick them up, or one's own appointments, or just commuting to work. Mm-hmm. Also, it's a way to catch ideas and inspiration, and it keeps feeding that fire to keep going. So I have found recording to be immensely helpful, because that's a little more flexible sometimes than being able to sit down at a computer, at a paper. And then it just, as I said, it fuels the desire to write.
Yeah, very much so. So, well, what are you working on now, and what doubts or fears have come up for you while you're working?
Again, thank you for asking. I mentioned that 2 years ago, after I started the novel, my historical novel, The Tremble of Love, more than 15 years ago.
Okay.
And I've, because of my son's intense needs, I would pick it up, put it down, pick it up. Once I put it down for 3 whole years. Okay. But now there's no stopping me. So I'm working on bringing that book forward into the world. It feels like a very important book to me. It illumines the presence and power of love, as you said in the introduction. It's full of adventure. It's just a wonderful, as some people have said, it transports, because it's set in the 1700s, and those 100 books helped make it as real as possible. It's quite a journey, but it's also a journey into the heart. So, you know, there have been so many fears and challenges on the way, all the research I had to do. I mentioned putting the book down for so long. My daughter's needs need to support myself. But the fact is that the book and its characters always called me back. And maybe other readers can relate to that. But those of us, you know, who write fiction, these characters, you know, are alive. And they, I feel like we become responsible to them. Yeah. And it's just wonderful. They help us move through doubt to rendezvous with them, to keep developing the story. And so what happened right after I got the funding for my son is I actually decided this is it. And I had turned 16 a little before that, and I went, this is it, this is it. Because it's so easy to say someday when I retire, or for people who are younger, when the kid, you know, when the kids are grown up, or when blah, when what. But I just, it was like, it's now. And so I didn't have my son here, so this was possible. I holed up in my New England farmhouse deep in the winter, lived on rice, beans, and kale, greens.
Right.
Yeah. I hardly drove my car, suspended the writing groups I was leading, and I dove into the 1700s. Mm-hmm. Part of not driving my car was saving money, and part of not driving my car was I really wanted to be immersed in this time period.
Okay.
And I wrote, gosh, 18 hours a day maybe, I mean, between writing and revising, and it flew by. I mean, it was in heaven. I had to come out of my cave, but when I came out, which was actually the night of the tsunami, the Japanese tsunami, that's the night that I finished the last revision of, I had several revisions of this 750-page manuscript.
Wow.
So one of the challenges, I mean, now of course, writing is one thing, and then publishing is another. And one literary agent I wrote to fairly early on, her response to me was, you do know that this is twice the acceptable length for a book in this genre.
Right.
Kind of, I could see her finger wagging, you know, and I watched myself cave. But, you know, what I notice is I don't cave as long as I used to. I mean, once it was 20 years, right? And then it would be a few years or a few months or a few weeks or a few days. Now I think I was down for maybe an hour. I cried a little bit, and I heard doubt say, yeah, right, who's going to publish this book? Yeah, right.
Yeah.
You know what people say about fiction. You should write a self-help book, you know, and all this stuff. But you know what? I got up because I had to. That doesn't mean along the way I haven't had to put it aside to, I couldn't continue to live on rice and beans. So
yeah.
I put my writing groups back. But my main job now feels like it's to stay connected to faith, to keep getting out of my own way, which means be less tempted by doubt and, you know, deceived by doubt, and to listen to what's often so quiet I can barely hear it, inner guidance, to put one foot in front of the other. So what I've done, in short, I'm doing some creative things to launch the as yet unpublished novel and to build a platform. And so I'm in the middle of creating a website, and should be available for listeners to visit at trembleoflove.com, where podcasts of my readings from the unabridged book can be downloaded. And people have told me, nobody does that. Nobody does that. You know, and I'm doing it. And I'm doing it. And I might launch a Kickstarter campaign, because I'm beginning to think more about the benefits of self-publishing and why I might want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I haven't started, but it's a possibility also. And so I keep on keeping on. I continue, you know, my full-time also. So it's having really two jobs, which I keep trying to make into one somehow. But I continue my work with Dance of the Letters, you know, Dance of the Letters writing, supporting writers to find and free their voices. And I also am starting a blog called Harvesting Love. That's because it's another kind of writing I love to do, which is just narratives about personal narratives, about really there's a Kabbalistic practice called, you know, finding and freeing the sparks, the divine sparks hidden in unexpected places. And I feel like, you know, when we live with awareness, you know, love is everywhere. So even in hard experiences. So this blog is going to be lots of little stories, and some of them will be about writing and inspirational to writers.
Oh, good. Is the book still at 750, or did you revise it?
Well, what I'm doing as I'm recording the podcasts, I'm editing. And I'm honing and tightening, but I really, I went through the whole thing many times. So it's you know, covers four generations. It's it's epic kind of in proportion, which explains its length. But, you know, I hope to come out the other end with less pages, mostly because, you know, the word on the street is it'll be easier to sell. But I won't compromise the novel to make it easier to sell. I won't compromise the integrity of the novel. So, you know, I'll learn as I go.
Yeah. And I know you said you're just now exploring self-publishing versus a more traditional route, I guess. Has any conversations with doubt come up about exploring self-publishing or self-publishing your novel?
Oh, good question. I think doubt came up about, you know, mainstream publishing, because I've never felt mainstream, as you can, you know, from the time I was really young. So I've never felt mainstream. So it was funny to think of mainstream publishing, and yet that's, I haven't given that up. But so, you know, doubt would come up and say all sorts of things about, you know, book is weird, too spiritual, too long, too fat, too, you know, too, not enough, you know, all that stuff.
Right.
And then I recently had a discussion with somebody actually from Balboa Press, which is the self-publishing arm of Hay House, and they've started a transformative fiction division, Hay House has. And so I was just conversing, and what it did is, she wasn't trying to convince, well, maybe she was a little, but what it did is it just, again, it planted some seeds about having more autonomy. Like, I'm really, I would be very disappointed if the book had a cover I didn't like. And you give up a lot of autonomy in the publishing process. Not to mention, I think I owe it to myself to find out more about digital publishing and just learn more about all of that. And not turn it all over to a mainstream publisher. So I'm exploring that. I'm exploring it. And doubt says, you know, oh, this is going to be arduous. You know, you're going to make a big mistake. That's one of doubt's favorite lines. You're going to blow it. You're going to make a big mistake. And so, you know, I hear it. And sometimes I'm gentle with doubt. Sometimes I just kind of turn away and, you know, and sometimes dialogue gently, you know, that always seems to work the best, briefly and gently. It frees me. I think when I bring compassion in, it really transforms the experience. There's an edge doubt has, almost like a really frightened, defensive being, you know, that, you know, they're scared, and I can almost picture it, you know, the back's up, and they're scared.
Yeah.
An animal, for that matter, that's back is raised and tail is up. But when they know they're safe and you know, they're not going to get battled or there's affection even there, you know, there's more ease. Doubt sort of drops its arms, its attack.
Yeah, so be gentle with yourself and gentle with the doubt you're feeling.
Yeah, and fierce about writing. It's like both, right? It's like be gentle. It's so interesting. It's such a combination of be gentle and be a warrior. Because I never could have kept going if it weren't for both. If it weren't for forgiving myself when I was too tired to write or my son was just too sick. Or, you know, couldn't breathe and what was, you know, I had to be where I had to be. And I have no regrets about that. what I call surrender, but in a good sense.
Mm-hmm.
That was, you know, I also said yes to him coming.
Right.
To him. So no regrets, but it is, it's a combination of this gentleness and warrior. I'm going to keep doing this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Kind of keeping on those same lines. If you had one advice to give listeners about dealing with any of the challenges they're facing and doubt, what would that be?
Well, I'm thinking about that, and and what came was this, and then also a beautiful quote from the poet Rumi.
Oh,
so
yes.
What came is, treasure your desire to write like a fire you've been assigned to tend.
Mm-hmm.
And if doubt and fear cause the fire to smolder, breathe life into it with your passion, your faith, and your commitment.
Mm.
And above all, fuel the fire with your love for your writing, for the writer you are, and for your readers. So fueling that fire with our passion for writing, and for ourselves as writer, and for our readers, and just keep writing. And this is a wonderful quote that's been so inspirational to me by the poet Rumi.
Mm-hmm.
I have it almost in every room in my house. It says, feel yourself being quietly drawn by the deeper pull of what you truly love.
Mm. That's really nice.
If that is to write fiction, go for it.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. That was a question about doubt. Do you have any other advice just in general about writing? Like if you could give one piece of advice.
Well, it's to keep on keeping on. But also what I said earlier is to trust your voice.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean we can't learn. It doesn't mean, you know, we can't grow and change. But I know in all my years, I've been working with writers now from 7 to actually 88.
Wow.
The past 30, let's see, my daughter's 30, turning 32, for the past 31 years.
Okay.
And one of the things that's so wonderful is encouraging people to really allow and find their unique voices and to trust that. And that can be a process, you know, because doubt squelches that. Doubt and fear can keep us from finding our own voices, from freeing our voices. So trusting and being willing to experiment and keep writing and take risks, even when it's just between, you know, the writer and herself or himself, you know, to sit down and, you know, write deeply into something, to really find one's own voice. And it isn't, it changes too. It's not one voice, like we always have the same tone or anything, or we're even always writing, you know, in the same genre. But we begin to come from a deeper place in whatever we're writing, and we can feel that. We can feel that we're tapping into, sometimes they call it essence. We're really tapping into essence. And when we're writing, no matter what the genre is, we're able to bring that essence through our words and through the forms we use. And that is awesome. It's like flowers, you know? If they were all the same, even if they were all cultivated roses, you know, it would be boring. But, some of them are these immensely fragrant leaves of the valley, but they're tiny and they're often hidden under, you know, green blades. And there they are. And then there's, you know, the giant delphinium. And it's just to sort of give our own colors, our own fragrance, and to the garden of people, to the garden of writers.
Yeah, I love the idea of the garden. I think that'll hit home for a lot of people.
Yeah. It's an analogy that grew out of my work with children for years, still wanting them to not aspire to the right way to write, which schools often are teaching, but wanting them to find their way. And some of them would sit down and write, you know, five lines, and others would have written four pages.
Right, yeah.
To nurture, to, you know, so the analogy, you know, to the Lily of the Valley, and some of them were so shy, and some of them were very outspoken and extroverted, and so, you know, these analogy, the first analogy was the giant delphinium that's so royal, deep blue, and stands so tall, but has no fragrance. Mm-hmm. So there's beauty, it's not to say it's worse or better, but it sort of each has its place in the garden, and they got that. No, they got that. And I still know I use it with the adults who come to, who do groups with me. Because I use it with me to remind me.
Well, I'm so glad you're doing what you're doing. And I'm so glad you're able to speak to us. Because you're a really inspirational person. And you have said so many great things today.
Oh, thank you. You know, Cora, thank you for the opportunity. Because how can I say it? Writing has been my lifelong companion. And I feel I love writing so much. And it's sort of to honor writing and to support people, to know the joys, what I sometimes call the healing joys of writing, it just gives me so much pleasure. It's like giving back to writing, what writing has given me.
Yeah, I like that. I think that speaks to a lot of us. Ani, you've said so many great things today. I've really appreciated you being here. I know you have some fun gifts you want to tell the audience about.
I do. And I'm really excited, Cora, also. Earlier in the interview, I mentioned the project I have of making available recordings of me reading from my novel, The Tremble of Love.
Yeah.
And I'm really excited to offer to the fearless writers listening a free gift of the very first recordings available to listeners for download.
Oh, how exciting.
Yeah,
that'd
and
be
it's,
great.
It's very wonderful because it's been in the works and the listeners will be the first to be receiving this gift.
Oh,
and
awesome.
And a link for people to be able to access those downloads. And it's almost an hour of listening.
Oh, wow.
It's the preface, the prologue, and the first two chapters of the book. So I'm really excited about that. And also, I want to gift the participants of the summit a brand new ebook that I wrote really with the participants of the summit in mind. And it's called From Doubt to Freedom, A Guide for Writers and Other Creatives.
Awesome.
And as I say in the interview and in the preface of the book, I've been, you know, an intimate companion with doubt and the inner.
Yeah.
So I'm a veteran and have a lot to share about the process, really, of befriending ourselves and our inner doubt. And really one of the phrases I use in the book is, it is a process of making love, not war. We can't really fight the critics. We need to come to them and to ourselves, which they're part of, with love.
Yeah, very much so. And I bet all our participants are going to look forward to being veterans with your guidance.
Thank you, Cora, and thank you so much for this opportunity. It's just a wonderful opportunity you've created for so many of us.
Oh, well, thank you so much for joining us. You have such a great tone and so many great things to share.
Thank you.
And we'll have the link to Ani's great gifts on the Fearless Writing Telesummit homepage. And thank you guys so much for joining us today. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. And I'll see you guys tomorrow.